Hello and welcome to The Sound of Thinking. I'm Kelly Dean Jolly. In this episode, episode two, I'm very pleased to be joined by Paul Mensch, who's professor of philosophy at the University of Montana. His research focuses on Kierkegaard, specifically Kierkegaard's interpretation of Socrates, and how Kierkegaard himself employed a Socratic method in some of his writings. Paul also has interests in ancient Greek and Roman philosophy, Thoreau and Nietzsche, the history of analytic philosophy, Wittgenstein, and philosophy of literature and film. Very pleased to have you with us, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we're going to be talking today about Socrates and religion, and we're going to focus, to the extent that we do, on any text on Plato's Apology. And I thought that a good way of getting us started would be to just have you, if you would, give us a brief rundown of what you take to be the highlights, if that's the right term, of Plato's Apology. And once we've gotten those in mind, we can start our conversation.
Okay, that sounds good. I was thinking about that a little, and I think if you're sort of, in terms of broad brushstrokes, there's maybe three topics or things happening in this, which is a speech, right? Socrates is speaking in the first person for the most part. Occasionally, other characters he recognizes, or he has a little bit of a conversation with Miletus. He also, I think, since we know he likes to have conversations, that's his main way of interacting. He often will, there's multiple places in the Apology where he will imagine the jury or members of the jury asking him a question, and then he responds. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I would say that is really important about the Apology is just Socrates providing this portrait of himself, of his life as a philosopher, how he relates that to a kind of religious mission. And the way that he presents that is in terms of three questions that he imagines the jury asking him at different points. So the first question just being, you know, what is it that do you do, Socrates? Like, what is your occupation? Then later there's another question, which is, hey, Socrates, aren't you ashamed that the thing that you do has led you to the present situation? And then the final question is, Socrates, can't you stop doing what you do? Like, you know, couldn't we like send you into exile or something and you just keep quiet? Like, couldn't you just go away or something? So those are sort of the big questions that seem to guide that portrait of himself and his life that he sketches. Obviously, there's also just the fact that this is a legal proceeding. He's in a court. Charges have been filed against him. And so he does respond to those charges. It's interesting. There's lots of places where he doesn't so much talk about the charges that, or the way he puts it is he'll say that he's going to defend himself. Mm-hmm. Also, though, along the way, as is often the case in conversations that Socrates has with people, he will remind them of proper procedure or of what a concept actually amounts to, what follows from it. So in this case, he'll talk about what he thinks the proper role of a juror is, what the proper role of a defendant is, you know, that sort of thing. And he'll also criticize improper practices. So in the case of Miletus, for example, he sort of basically accuses him of being a kind of comic buffoon, somebody who is engaging in practices that are not suitable to the legal context. Later in his speech, he'll talk about how there's also a common practice for people to engage in kind of pleading and, you know, trying to evoke pity on the part of the jury. And he, so that's another case where there's a kind of improper drama, you might say. So comedy mm-hmm. and drama working their way in ways that Socrates thinks is inappropriate. And he'll kind of contrast that with his plan, which is to tell the jury the whole truth. But he knows that that's unusual, that the normal practice is to try to persuade by any means necessary, right? You're just mm-hmm. trying to convince the jury of something. And he also knows, I mean, that when people use those kinds of tools, that there is a danger to those who are listening that they may forget themselves. They may sort of get so carried away by what they're hearing that they sort of lose track of themselves. Also that they may not be in a position, in the case where somebody is speaking the truth, to hear that truth or receive it in a way where they can appreciate it. So sometimes when he tells somebody the truth, he says a common response is that they get very angry, and they act, you know, poorly. They may mistreat him or someone else, but for him, like, what's really bad about that is that they end up hurting themselves because they do something wrong or unjust. Mm-hmm. So those are two, I would say, kind of big topics. And then maybe the third one is just looking at Socrates and how he kind of holds up under duress in court. I mean, he's in these proceedings, and one of the things he says about himself is that he is not afraid of death, and he has some interesting things to say why. But I also think sort of Plato is sort of depicting him as a kind of a new sort of philosophical hero. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people can say they're not afraid of death, but there's sort of a question of, well, how do they hold up when they're put to the test? And I think that's another interesting thing about what's going on in the Apology. And it's worth kind of keeping in mind, because sometimes we can get like caught up in the details of the trial and how it's unfolding and that sort of thing. But just sort of remembering that throughout the whole thing, hovering over this whole thing, is that his life is in danger and that there are real threats. And you know, he maintains his composure and his sense of humor, and and maybe even kind of, for some people, he behaves in a way that they don't think is appropriate. His, you know, his sense of decorum isn't quite what maybe they're used to.
Right, right.
So I would say, yeah, those are kind of in broad strokes the things that strike me most about the Apology.
Yeah, I think the need to keep in mind that this really is a life and death proceeding, as you put it, the death is sort of hanging over the speech that Socrates gives, is incredibly important. And I think Plato never intended his readers to forget it. It's something I think similar in many of the dialogues, where it's easy to lose sight of the fact that when Socrates is talking to some sophist like Protagoras or someone, from at least the sophist's point of view, you know, that particular man's livelihood is at stake. You know, this isn't just about abstract discussion. It's about winning students over, being paid, and so on. And it's easy, I think, in those other dialogues to lose that sort of existential dimension of the discussion, as it's easy here to lose this very serious existential dimension of the discussion.
Right. Yeah, no, I agree completely.
Well, we're going to talk some more about the details of the Apology and some of the highlights that you've mentioned. But just for a second, I'm going to ask you to sort of step back from it, just because I want to think for a moment with you about the variety of Socrateses that there are. I mean, we're obviously here talking right now about Plato's Socrates, but it's easy to forget, and some, of course, won't know, that we also have a portrait of Socrates that's supplied to us by Xenophon. Other portraits of Socrates we could talk about. Certainly we have Kierkegaard coming later, telling us a great deal about Socrates. So could you maybe talk a little bit about how you think about the relationships among the historical, the Xenophonic, the Platonic Socrates, and other Socrates as we might mention?
Sure. There's a nice book by Charles Kahn, who talks a lot about this. And he and others have drawn attention to is just how it's important for people to realize that the Socratic conversation was a genre. So that in a way, because Plato made the genre or made it his own, and he's the one that, as far as the tradition goes, that, I mean, he's sort of head and shoulders of everybody else, that, you know, sometimes we lose track of that. But as you mentioned, we have quite a few things that Xenophon wrote that are also, they have a family resemblance anyway to what Plato writes. Mm-hmm. But we have fragments from others as well. So, I mean, basically, lots of people wrote these conversations where Socrates was one of the main characters. And so that's interesting. It's certainly something that the search for the historical Socrates, I don't know that it's as pressing a question to people right now, but at different times, it certainly has been something where there's been a real interest in what do we make of these different representations of Socrates and how do they relate to the historical man, especially because he didn't write anything as far as we know, or at least if he did, it didn't survive. So he's always portrayed as somebody who likes to engage in philosophical discussions. And obviously there are also can be questions about why it is that the Socratic dialogue was chosen as the sort of optimal way of representing this. I mean, clearly it kind of mimics, we think, the sorts of conversations he liked to have, but also it has a nice way of allowing for whoever the author is to perhaps engage in a kind of interaction with their readers that might mimic some of the conversations Socrates has with the characters in these different dialogues. But then naturally people want to say, but when Socrates is represented speaking a particular opinion or making a certain argument, well, do we have any reason for thinking that he held those views himself? And some people want to know, maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe maybe we can't tell. Maybe we can't determine it. Kierkegaard, as you mentioned, I mean, he comes much later and he's, I've learned a lot from him about how to think about these questions. He's not someone that I would say, you know, has been as appreciated as he might have been within sort of analytic mainstream ancient philosophy, partly because he's a bit removed. He's coming out of the post-Kantian tradition. He's inherited his philosophical vocabulary from Hegel. And so there's a pretty large burden put on the reader to try to come to terms with his text. But basically what he argues is that if you want to try to find the historical Socrates insofar as that's a meaningful task, what you need to do is take these different sources and sort of set them up against each other. And he doesn't think that any of them are entirely accurate or sort of, you know, he thinks all of them are inflected by the concerns and interests of a given author. So whether in the case of Plato, somebody who has a real intellectual theoretical drive, you know, he's a philosopher in the capital P sense of the word, or someone like Xenophon, who was a historian, a general, a politician. He's kind of a more of a can-do sort of guy. And he tends, you know, his Socrates has a more, maybe a more down-to-earth practical sort of side that comes out a bit more. Kierkegaard's not a particularly big fan of Xenophon. He thinks he's shallow and misses the, you know, the depth of Socrates. I think he's sometimes is a little unfair to him. He just, his interest is primarily Plato, as is most people's.
I recall and then somewhere Kierkegaard talks about what he calls Xenophonic limpness versus Platonic tautness when thinking about Socrates.
Right. And I mean, so he thinks if you, even if you just have those two pictures of Socrates in view, that his idea is there, Socrates must have been a certain way so that, you know, he must have had a certain kind of nature so that when he came into a contact with a Plato, we got what we got. And when he came into a contact with Xenophon, we got what we got. And he's trying to make the case that you can extrapolate backwards to, you know, solve for X. And in his view, Aristophanes is right in there in the mix. Again, not a not a well-respected view maybe nowadays, although as I was mentioning to you the other day, I mean, I think Aristophanes has a deeper grasp of Socrates than he's often given credit for. But from Kierkegaard's point of view, the comic way that Aristophanes has of representing Socrates provides an interesting way of correcting maybe or rounding out the various ways in which Socrates can be portrayed, and he sort of adds a third dimension. And I think what he thinks is you can extrapolate back. Those are three coordinates, like Plato, Xenophon, and Socrates, and Aristophanes, and you can maybe plot what the actual Socrates was based on that. One thing that Kierkegaard does have in common, I would say, with most scholars, is he treats Plato's Apology as a special text. So whereas he thinks that most of Plato's dialogues are kind of driven by Plato's own philosophical project or what have you, his own interests and needs, he thinks that there is a more of a historical character to the Apology. And so for him, that's sort of whatever you're going to say about Socrates, he thinks you have to start with that text. If you end up saying something about Socrates that is contradicted by that text, well, then so much the worse for what you had to say. And I think that's pretty common. And for me as well. I mean, I think whoever Socrates is, it always begins and ends with Plato's Apology.
I don't remember who said it. Maybe you know, but there's some remark somewhere where someone is contrasting Xenophon's Socrates with Plato's, and basically the thing that's said is that, well, one thing that tells in favor of Plato's portrait over Xenophon's portrait is that it's hard to imagine Xenophon's Socrates being put to death, not so hard to imagine Plato's Socrates being put to death.
It's funny. I don't know who said that. I've had that thought some of the time. I mean, when you read, because Xenophon, like Plato, there are places in his writings where he is definitely engaging in an attempt to defend Socrates from the various charges. And it does seem almost like he overdoes it sometimes. I mean, like he makes it out to be like that there's just almost like no way that you can even understand how the charges were even brought. I mean, like his Socrates doesn't seem, and the way that Kierkegaard likes to joke about this, and he just says, he's just sort of like this happy uncle, you know, who shows up and kind of has a genial chat with you. Why would the state be bothered by such a person? Why would people be bringing these capital charges against him? Or any, like, he just seems like he's made Socrates too tame or something like that.
No, that's right. He does sometimes seem a little like he's sitting in a rocking chair in front of a Cracker Barrel.
Right.
Yeah. Well, let's move on back into the Apology then. And feel free, of course, to bring these things back in as you choose. But I wanted to ask a little bit now about some of the things that you mentioned Socrates is saying, highlight moments. As you said, Socrates is crucially concerned in the Apology with trying to make clear, in a sense, what his life is, why his life is as it is. You know, to borrow a phrase of Bradley's, it's sort of my station and its duties, you know, that Socrates seems to be telling the jurors and others about. And a crucial part of that story is the story about the Delphic Oracle. And I was wondering if you could just say a little bit about that story and then a little bit about how you think about Socrates' reaction to what the Delphic Oracle says and how that plays a role in what Socrates goes on to do with his life.
Sure. It's interesting. I mean, so apparently the Delphic, I mean, you know, the site of the temple where the oracle was, they have done archaeological work on this, and there are certain gases that they have found that would sort of apparently, you know, like the Pythian priestess would go into this chamber and I guess sort of inhale some of these gases and enter into a trance-like state of some sort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as often the problem, people would ask the question and then they would get an oracular response where they weren't really, you know, you got to be careful, obviously, when you interact with the gods and you got to, but I mean, one of the examples I remember is someone, you know, a king who was thinking about invading his neighbor and sort of saying, you know, something like, you know, should I invade, basically? And the the oracle's response was, if you invade, a great kingdom will fall. And the guy was like, awesome. And he invaded and he lost and his kingdom fell. So you have to be careful, right? When you get these answers. And I mean, one thing that, of course, in the context of the legal setting, where one of the charges against Socrates is that he doesn't believe in the gods of the city and introduces new spiritual things. Mm-hmm. This is kind of a vague phrase, but you know, broadly, he's being charged with religious unorthodoxy of some sort or another. It's interesting that, and he even uses this term, I think he says, I'm going to call on the god, basically, and this is the god Apollo, as a witness, you know, here in my trial. So, yes. So sort of to defend against the charge of religious unorthodoxy, he is going to bring religion into the discussion and partly why he does this is because, and this is a little bit in answer to that question, you know, Socrates, what is your occupation? And he has initially, maybe against the advice of his lawyers, instead of just immediately responding to the legal charges, he said, well, you know, before I talk about the legal charges, I need to talk about some older accusations that people have been making against me. Like, you know, people have been slandering me for years. They've been sort of accusing me of all these stock charges that are often brought against philosophers, the sort of thing that Aristophanes portrays in The Clouds to comic effect, that they make the weaker argument appear the stronger, and that they sort of engage in a kind of naturalistic philosophy that frequently debunks traditional myths and stories about the gods. Right. And those who are accused of that, the implication is that they are atheists. And Socrates says, a lot of people have been accusing him of that, all of these kind of stock charges for years. But he says, you know, they're not true. He doesn't really say much about Aristophanes, but he does note that it is a comedy. So I think it's worth, you know, I think there is an apocryphal story that Socrates supposedly attended the performance of The Clouds and stood up when the character playing Socrates came out on stage. He stood up so that the audience could compare and contrast them and see in what way does this, you know, the mask that he's wearing or whatever resemble the actual Socrates. But basically, what he imagines is after he's sort of denied these stock charges, he sort of imagines the jury saying, well, but Socrates, you must be doing something, right? I mean, right. People aren't going to just start accusing you of all these things for no reason. So like, could you, you know, what is your job? Like, how is it that you're occupying yourself? You must be doing something unusual. And that's where he begins talking about the oracle. I mean, he says, okay, I'm going to tell you this. And I know it's going to seem outrageous. It's going to seem like I'm bragging. But I, you know, I feel like I need to do this if you're going to understand better what's going on. And the other thing it's worth noting is that he's not the one, he didn't go to the oracle himself and say, hey, is there anybody wiser than me? He just, it wasn't a kind of self initiated question. It was raised by this friend of his, Chaerephon, who he said was sort of known for being impulsive.
Yes.
I don't know how, I mean, he was impulsive, but he also, I mean, I think he had to pay a significant amount of money. You couldn't just like show up at the oracle and, you know, ask a question, right? It was still a significant undertaking. And he did this, he asked the question, is anybody wiser than Socrates? And the answer was basically no. You know, so sometimes the oracle just says no. And then, and Socrates says he's amazed by this. He doesn't know what to make of it. He doesn't think of himself as especially wise. I mean, obviously he's known as frequently kind of calling himself ignorant. And there's a kind of an interesting question about how to think about what that amounts to. I mean, he's obviously knows how to tie his shoes. He can give you directions to the center of town.
Right. Right.
So my shorthand for that is he sort of thinks he's ignorant about important life matters or something like that. There's nothing special about what he knows that like people should come to him and consult with him as an expert or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yet the god says no one is wiser than he, and that he feels like, well, that's a source he needs to take seriously. He can't just blow it off. It's not like a friend in a bar was, you know, kicking back, having a beer and said, you know, Socrates, nobody's wiser than you. Like, this is coming from an important place. So he feels like he needs to take it seriously, but he doesn't know what to do. It basically strikes him, he says, as a riddle.
Yes.
And so he just kind of mulls it over and thinks about it. And then he says, reluctantly, he eventually decided, all right, I need to try to test this. And this is partly because this is what Socrates does. I mean, so in
Yes.
a way, like the first answer to his question, what do I do, is I try to refute things. I try to test either propositions or the people who've uttered them, often a combination of the two. But you can see that's a little dicey in this case because it's coming from a divine source. So he doesn't want to do it, but he feels like if he just sits there and doesn't do anything, that's also not acceptable. So since he can't just sit there and do nothing, he needs to respond to it. He needs to take it seriously. And the only way he knows how, or the best way he knows how, is to test it and kind of go about and see what he can make of this, right? And
Yes.
that's sort of the launch into his second maybe answer, or his specification of his answer to what he does, which is he goes around and seeks out people who, especially those who have a reputation for wisdom. Because he thinks, well, look, if I can find somebody who's wiser than me, it'll show that the oracle's wrong. I will have refuted it. And that, I don't know what he would have concluded if he had found such a person. But as we know, he didn't. Or he claimed, you know, he spends his whole life going around testing people, checking. And there's a nice passage that Plato has, which I love, where he just very, the first, he, when he's describing the first person that he talks about, where it's just very generic. I mean, he says, well, look, this is what I do. You know, I went to this person and I talked with him for a while. And basically what he concludes from their conversation is, he says, I thought that he appeared wise to many people and especially to himself, but was not, but he was not. Mm-hmm. I then tried to show him that he thought himself wise, but that he was not. As a result, he came to dislike me, and so did many of the bystanders. That's it. Like, he doesn't say how he did it. He doesn't say what philosophical questions he asked or his procedure. Like, it's just, like a very nice generic picture. Like, that's what he does. He goes around, tests people, and if they appear ignorant to him, he tries to share that with them. And they're frequently, the response that they have to him doing that is to get angry and at him, not at themselves. Right. And
right.
And so that's his account. Like, his explanation for why it is that all these people have been saying these lies about him is that when people get in this situation where their ignorance has been exposed, they don't like it. And then they say, you know, Socrates, you're a jerk, or that Socrates is a real jerk. And people say, well, why? And he says, they don't really know what to say, because the reason why they're mad isn't because of Socrates. They're mad because their ignorance has been exposed. So he says, then they just reach for these stock charges, right? Yeah. So that's his kind of, his sort of diagnosis of where this came from. And it, and also in a way, it's a kind of founding myth for kind of how he became a philosopher. But it's also worth noting, I think, that Socrates has been, must have been doing some of this stuff earlier, even if he isn't yet thinking of himself
right.
exactly as a philosopher.
Chaerephon had some reason to ask the question.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. I mean, just thinking a little bit about, you know, the kind of character Socrates was, and the, I think, difficulty that not only the Athenians have, but that we have too, finding sort of adequate categories in which to think about him. Because, you know, there's this funny way in which, you know, it looks as though there's an appeal to a kind of orthodoxy in telling the story about visiting the oracle and what the oracle had to say. But then, of course, Socrates' response to what the oracle says smacks of heterodoxy. I mean, it's almost as though, as you said, he seems as though he's trying to refute what the god has told him, as though, you know, the idea is something like, well, I'll find Bob in Athens who will be wiser than me, and I'll drag him back to Delphi and I'll say, see here, you know, tell Apollo. This isn't how it works. I'm not the wisest man. Bob is the wisest man, or at any rate, he's better than I am. And I think what's interesting is that in calling it a riddle, the word you use, the word Socrates, in a way, inflects hard there. I think he is saying something like, what puzzled me is that this had the appearance of falsehood, but I don't think Socrates thought it could be false, given this. Ultimately, the person pronouncing, or the being pronouncing, the the oracle. And so it's, you know, it's as though Socrates is living his life out in the space of a riddle, you know, trying to figure out how to understand something that looks false on its face, but that he takes it, that he takes not to be false. And then, you know, in some way, his career as a philosopher becomes his way of trying to overcome the appearance of falsehood in the oracle by finding, as it were, a truth, you know, beneath the surface of the words, borne out by, you know, his continual conversations with people in Athens.
Right. No, that I like the way you put that. And I mean, partly it seems it has to do with, I mean, part of what makes it a riddle is his own understanding of himself. I mean, that, you know, yes, as he puts it, I don't think I'm particularly knowledgeable about anything worth knowing. So what do I make of that? And I think, even though it's true that initially the way why he sort of begins this task or this life calling or this occupation is, as he puts it, initially the initial terms in which he describes it are that I'm going to try to refute the oracle. But I think over time, as he engages in this more and more and sort of starts thinking about it and kind of seeing, well, you know, basically repeatedly as he has these conversations with people, he will come away with the thought, oh, it's true, there is a sense in which I am wiser than this person. Like, I still wouldn't say that I have anything, you know, some great expertise, but I also don't think that I do. And that's right. That's that one little, and I think as he begins to see that, he connects that to maybe, oh, well, maybe that's the sense in which the God meant no one is wiser than I. It doesn't mean that he's calling me a genius or something like that. He's saying, well, among, and I think really it's true that, like, Socrates, I mean, because he'll say, like, really the moral of this, of what the oracle says is not, hey, Socrates is a genius. It's that only the gods are wise.
Right.
And that among human beings, it's not there are the wise and then there are the ignorant. It's like we're all ignorant more or less, but there are grades of ignorance, or there, you know, there are those who are sort of ignorant, but they're unaware of their being ignorant. And then those who are ignorant and they're aware of it. And that, so Socrates thinks, yeah, I might be a little bit wiser than a lot of the people I've had these conversations with. And so he can kind of, I think he does find a way that it can be true without him, but while his own self understanding remains true as well. Like he finds a way to kind of be able to say, yeah, there is something about my condition that perhaps is better than the condition of a lot of his interlocutors. And at the same time, it isn't really about me. It's about, in a certain way, it's about human hubris, where human beings think that they are closer to the gods than they actually are. Maybe they don't appreciate the gods. They don't, you know, they don't show proper reverence or gratitude or what have you. They think, oh, I don't need them. And this is maybe one way that, this is something, a point I think that Kierkegaard makes, that this is one way that he thinks that Socrates is not like most of the Western philosophical tradition that follows him. So whether it's Plato or Aristotle and everybody else, that where the idea is human beings are rational, the sort of divine of us that is closest to the gods is that part. And that, you know, our main task is to sort of make ourselves as close to the divine as we can. Whereas maybe that isn't exactly what Socrates takes away from this. It's more stressing that there's this unbridgeable gap or divide between the human on the one hand and the divine on the other.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting to me that, you know, that word riddle, coming back to it just one last time, I mean, there's an interesting sense in which Socrates clearly thinks of himself as a riddle, at least, you know, in a number of the dialogues, he says things that are tantamount to saying that, even if he doesn't use the word. I think it's in the Phaedrus where he says, you know, I don't know what kind of creature I am, if I'm like a many-headed hydra or something more gentle, right? And, you know, there's this just, I think, interesting way in which Socrates not only sees the oracle's pronouncement as a riddle, but, you know, there's a sense in which then he himself becomes a riddle or thinks of himself as a riddle. And I think that may also be tied to this, you know, this sense of what Socratic ignorance comes to, what his sense of the distance between the human and the divine.
Right. And I like that point, and that, I mean, the way that Socrates puts it is that he's being put forward as a kind of, representative instance of just the human human being. Like, so that I think that maybe you might say then he would also say that we're all riddles, that's part of what it is to be human, is to kind of not lose sight of that and not kind of become so sure of ourselves that we stop being puzzled and troubled and that sort of thing.
Well, let me ask you, particularly since you spend a lot of time thinking about Kierkegaard and Kierkegaard's understanding of Socrates, can you say a little bit about Socrates's irony, how maybe a little bit about how it's present, if you think of it as present in the Apology, but also just in general, what you think of that particular feature of Socrates's and how it fits into the particular sort of career that he had?
Sure. It's a very interesting topic. I mean, I think as far as in the last however many years, 50 years or so, the conversation was set off by this important paper of Gregory Vlastos's that eventually worked its way into his book on Socrates. I remember, I think Alexander Naumas had a paper I read where he argued that even though Vlastos doesn't mention him much, if any, by name, that he thought that Vlastos's sort of Socrates and his account of Socratic irony was sort of designed to be diametrically opposed to what Kierkegaard has to say. So there is a kind of interesting interplay there. I mean, one of the things, and this is some, I think Cornford has a book on comedy where he talks some about this, that and others, but just kind of noting how the Greek word that is the root of our term irony, how that changes over time, and how typically it was just associated with kind of being like a sly fox, a kind of, you know, and had connotations of lying and dishonesty, but that as it became associated with Socrates, especially Plato's Socrates, but I think you can find moments of him in Xenophon as well, that it takes on a different connotation. It comes up, Aristotle has a nice discussion of this in book 4 of the Nicomachean Ethics, where he's talking about the truthful person. And, you know, as is often the case, you know, when he's talking about the mean, there will be two different kinds of excess. So on the one hand, you have the person who's the boaster, who sort of will represent themselves as being more than they are. And then on the other hand, you have the mock modest person, the one who kind of downplays what they are. And Aristotle there ties that mock modesty to Socrates. And so by then, it's definitely come to be connected to Socrates. But for example, I mean, the term irony in Plato doesn't appear in that many places. I think the two most prominent that I can think of are the first book of the Republic, where Thrasymachus accuses him. And there, it's not meant to be praise. I mean, he's basically saying, you are a liar and a weasel, Socrates. The other place is in Alcibiades' speech in the Symposium, where he also talks about a kind of way that Socrates is this sort of riddle and has, like, you know, things that he keeps hidden from others, and kind of how he plays a kind of game and seems to, you know, at least in public, care about things that maybe he doesn't really care about in the way that people sometimes have the impression. And so those sorts of things are there. But I think how we think of irony is almost, I don't know that how much of Plato's, I think Plato was educating his audience to sort of notice and identify these features in Socrates, whereas for us, it's more common and more a part of how we think of it in a variety of texts. For Kierkegaard, I think he's the one that really put Socratic irony on the map. I mean, his whole book is called On the Concept of Irony, with continual reference to Socrates, and about two thirds of it are basically his attempt to solve the historical question, right? Who is Socrates? And remember, we were talking earlier about how he's going to solve for X. Well, X is irony. I mean, he's going to argue that Like Socrates' fundamental nature is ironic, and that only if it's ironic can we make sense of whether it's Plato or Xenophon or Aristotle, like the different ways that Socrates impressed these people and what they ended up, how they ended up portraying him. He thinks irony is the only explanation. Later, this is early, this is young Kierkegaard, this is his, basically the equivalent of his PhD dissertation that he wrote. And there's maybe a one-sidedness to this argument that where he basically pushes it for all he can. I think he's sort of taken with it himself and enjoys it. He knows that it'll be somewhat scandalous among at least the people on his committee. So oftentimes no one else reads your dissertation, but eventually in later writings, he is going to sort of say, well, you know, there are these other sides. He does want to view Socrates as an ethical figure, as a kind of religious intellectual martyr. And so depending on his own purposes, he will sort of stress different aspects of Socrates. But throughout, I mean, there is a real important sense in which he thinks Socrates was fundamentally an ironist. And he does, interestingly, argue that you can find this in the Apology. Remember, I mean, for him, like, that's a historical text. So he thinks if he can demonstrate that there's irony there, that will strengthen his case for trying to convince his readers that Socrates was ironic in a sort of more fundamental way, like at the level of being rather than merely at the level of discourse, you might say, or something, where it's not, like for him, irony is not merely a turn of phrase that you employ maybe for educative reasons or something, where you sort of say the opposite of what you mean, or where you say something that where there's it's clear to your the person you're talking with that you mean more than what you say, whatever. They don't quite know what you mean, but they sense that there's something they're not getting. That's part of what we enjoy, but there is a sense in which that maybe it could be connected to that idea of Socrates as a riddle that you mentioned. But for Kierkegaard, it's not just how he speaks. It's really his being itself. Like he thinks that there's an important way in which that's what kind of keeps Socrates going, that he has. I mean, one of the ways he puts it is when thinking about death, for example, in the Apology, you know, if you do see Socrates as being presented as possibly a new kind of hero, right? He compares himself to Achilles, one of the classic Greek heroes, maybe one of our paradigms of a brave person and how a brave person copes with the fear of death. As opposed to, say, a coward who, you know, so the brave person is able to stand their ground or maybe even eagerly go forward, you know, and kind of do what they have to do, whereas maybe the coward is the one who flees, you know, or who clings to life and isn't willing to risk their life for something like honor or decency. Kierkegaard argues that Socrates doesn't really fit either of those categories. He thinks Socrates is someone who has a different source of composure, like that his composure is his irony, that there's a way in which he kind of rests in that, and that he can kind of take a certain joy and certain delight or a kind of unboundedness that he sort of has discovered, something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Certainly the way Kierkegaard understands Socratic irony, it's not going to be reduced to the lyrics of an Alanis Morissette song.
No.
Yeah. In fact, I'm going to, at the end of the show today, it'll be outside the space of our conversation, but I'm actually going to end today's show with a reading of a brief paragraph or two from the On Irony book of Kierkegaard's, in which he describes Socrates as sort of existential irony. So those who are listening will get a chance to hear Kierkegaard talk about that before the show ends. Well, is there anything else about the Apology that you wanted to, you know, perhaps some other piece of it you wanted to dig down into a little bit, to talk a bit more about? I'll let you sort of steer us for a second if there was something you wanted to address that we haven't talked about yet.
Uh, Let's see. Well, maybe we haven't talked about, I mean, the other maybe way that maybe we could talk a bit more about how he draws on thinking of himself as a religious figure for thinking about his sort of life as a philosopher and kind Good. Of the decisions he makes, the choices he makes, because he employs this interesting image. I mean, partly what he's trying to do is explain to the jury why it is he's been doing these things and why, you know, what it is to be a philosopher. And then we've talked a little bit about how he imagines them saying, well, aren't you ashamed that you've kind of ended up here because of this? And that's where he does talk about how he responds to death and the fear. He treats the fear of death as actually a paradigmatic instance of a kind of ignorance where people think they know what death is. They think it's bad. And if you think something is bad, you fear kind of naturally follows. There's a kind of close connection for Socrates between the attitude or the, you know, your sort of way of cognitively assessing something and maybe an appropriate emotional response. Mm-hmm. He thinks that's not true and that rather you should do the right thing. You should stay by your post. And so he's kind of coming down more on the side of Achilles rather than on those who frequently are behaving in ways that he thinks are inappropriate. But there's still this kind of question, meanwhile, of trying to explain why he is the way he is. And a lot of this discussion comes after he's pretty quickly dismissed the strictly narrow legal charges that were raised against him by Meletus. Mm-hmm. And I often don't even teach those. Maybe I'm not being fair to Plato or the speech, but I do think that the reason that he doesn't spend that much time on them is because he thinks that Meletus is a kind of buffoon and that really he says, I think I've shown that I'm not guilty of these charges, but a lot of times people are like, no, you haven't, or you haven't answered these questions. But I think there is a sense in which he has, because what he pretty much shows is that it's not clear that there actually are that coherent charges have been brought against him. And that,
yes.
And you know, if there aren't actually charges that have been brought against him, then he can't be guilty of them. I mean, there are no charges yes. for him to be guilty of. So once he's kind of got past that, there is still this kind of, you know, like people are still like, but Socrates, you're annoying. You're always going around like, you know, you're kind of a busybody. You're going around showing people that they don't know these things. And yeah, maybe you got started by the oracle, but, you know, is it really the case that what you're doing is a kind of something that is sanctioned by the gods? I mean, and this is where he kind of describes himself famously as a gadfly, right?
Yes.
As this kind of horsefly. And he characterizes Athens as this noble but sluggish horse that needs to kind of be awakened, right? It's kind of, and it's important not to lose track of the noble. Like, so
yes.
he loves Athens and he has some problems with it, but he's always trying to get people to kind of find the best in the city or the best in themselves or the best in the courtroom or what have you. He's trying to kind of get people to care about things in the right sort of way. And this image, I it's brilliant. I mean, it may not work for everyone, but it's basically, he's sort of saying, well, look, this God-given task can be understood. I mean, I can be understood as sort of sent here by the gods to kind of help improve the city and my fellow citizens, to kind of wake them up. But also it makes clear that, you know, that's a dangerous activity. I mean, horses have tails for a reason, right?
Yes.
I mean, they often kill these flies, and that's the sort of danger of being a gadfly sent by the gods, is that the people that you awaken will not be happy about what you've done, and they'll take care of you. So there's a strange way that even as Socrates is telling this, even as he's trying to make clear to the jury why he's done what he's doing, he's telling them the truth. He's also, right, signaling throughout his speech that the very thing he's talking about, he is enacting with the jury. I mean,
yes.
he can't have his individual conversations with them one-on-one, which was his preference, but that's why I think he kind of he mimics a discussion with them as best he can. He imagines them asking questions, but I think he also imagines that they think they know who he is. They think they know who Socrates is. That's another species of this ignorance that he's often revealing. He's revealing to them that they're wrong, that they don't know. And he's also describing to them his common experience is that when he reveals people their ignorance, they get angry, but they don't get angry at themselves. They get angry at him. So guess what? He thinks it's not very likely that this is going to go well here. the jury is also probably going to get angry at him. And sure enough, it does. Right. So that's kind of like he fleshes out that religious mission. And I think, you know, that image of the gadfly is interesting, how he is able to connect what can otherwise look like, you know, problematic or unpleasant or difficult philosophical refuting activity to his God-given mission. But then, you know, the other thing maybe that to bring in is just that there is his divine sign as well, which is quite strange. So, you know, we could talk about that. And
let's do that.
Okay. So that we know, we don't know much about it, right? There's a passage in the Republic somewhere where Plato makes clear that this was unique. I mean, nobody else had this particular gift or calling or what have you. I mean, Socrates says in the Apology that it's been with him since he was a child. This is one case where Plato and Xenophon do not disagree. Sorry, they do disagree in how they describe it. Mm-hmm. Plato is very rigorous. It's always the case that the only thing that this voice does is basically say no or stop. So if Socrates is about to do something, the voice will just kind of stop him. It kind of keeps him from pursuing a line of questioning or going. Maybe he thinks, oh, I'm going to get a quart of milk, and he starts to go to the store and it stops him. He doesn't necessarily know why.
Right.
But he seems to have found inductively over time that maybe on reflection, he would look, oh yeah, if I had done that, I would have, you know, I would have forgotten that I was supposed to meet my friend, and then I wouldn't have been treating my friend well. So it's almost like there's a kind of a check on things where he might potentially do something wrong. That seems to be how he thinks of it. Whereas Xenophon, at least in one place, describes it as something more like a voice that says, hey, Socrates, don't do that. Or, hey, Socrates, you should do this other thing, or your friends, you know, you should recommend to Bob that he really apply for that job, right? Or whatever. And I don't think that, I mean, Plato never puts it that way. Kierkegaard ridicules Xenophon's take, and he just thinks that's just another instance of the flabbiness of Xenophon's thinking or something like that. But in any event, it is worth just kind of noting, like, that's kind of how things round out in his own speech. So that, right, I mean, Socrates gives the defense that he does. He explains as best he can. He tells the whole truth, even knowing that the jury may get angry, may end up putting him to death and all that. And then finally, after it's all over, right, he's been sentenced to death and he's just hanging out with the people that voted for his innocence. He just kind of says, hey, you know, in a more in a consoling way, maybe this isn't maybe it's not a bad thing what happened, right? And here are some reasons why. For my voice, you know, that it's been with me and stops me from all sorts of things my whole life. It never once said anything. And he takes that to be a sign that whatever, you know, however he's been proceeding was appropriate. Yes. There wasn't anything like, you know, and that's also interesting given that, you know, some of the things like, you know, he's got a strange legal strategy. Like his lawyers are probably just, you know, banging their heads against the wall as he's like bringing up all these other slanders and charges that people have brought in. And, you know, he's proposing what seem on the face of it to be outrageous penalties, right? I mean, he's been found guilty and, you know, in the Greek system or in, you know, in the Athenian system, right, each party would then propose a punishment. And the idea was supposed to kind of moderate what happens. And they propose death. And Socrates proposes that, like, the state support him and provide him with free
like
meals.
He's an Olympic victor.
Like this. Yeah. But, you know, presumably his voice could have stopped him there if that was a bad idea, and it didn't. So from the point of view of the divine, they had no problem with that, you know, whatever that means. And so Socrates takes some comfort in that, right? That there's a, you know, some sense in which, hey, I know you're not happy, and maybe he's not. I don't know whether he's. I mean, Xenophon is kind of funny because he has this sort of pragmatic take that, like, basically Socrates is like, you know, I'm getting old. Pretty soon, my faculties are going to start fading, right. And my body, you know, your joint. I'll need a knee replacement. Luckily, this trial has come along, and if I just goad the jury in the right sort of way, they'll sentence me to death, and then I can go out on, you know, on top.
My knee's intact.
Right. I think that's the kind of case where there's it's unintentionally funny that like to think that Socrates would approach things in that way. But what he is trying to console those who voted for innocence is that, look, the divine has sanctioned this. Like, there wasn't anything about how I did things that from the divine point of view was wrong. And he's going to return to this topic, right, in a more personal setting when he's in jail, like when Crito, when Crito goes and tries to convince him to break out of jail and, right, marshals all these arguments, because it was clear that the consensus among his friends was the whole thing was botched. It should never have gone to trial. The way that Socrates carried on was inappropriate. He shouldn't have been sentenced to death. You know, he should have proposed a reasonable penalty like exile. Everybody thinks if he had proposed exile, they would have gladly given it to him. They wanted him to just go away, problem solved. But he won't do that, right? Like that's the sort of critical thing. He says, I will not propose that. And that's sort of the answer to the third question, you know, can't you just stop doing this, Socrates, right? Can't you just stop being a philosopher? And he says, no, right? This, you know, now he's come to think of this as his God-given task. And he also thinks it's a good thing, having these philosophical conversations and making that a part of your life, testing yourself, testing your friends, trying to care as best you can about the things that matter. He's not going to stop doing that. There's nothing more valuable than that. So why would he give it up, right? Yes. And so somehow he has to find a way to kind of console those who are going to lose this person that they really care about. Just like I think clearly that's what he's trying to do in the Crito, like, with his good friend, Crito, he's trying to explain to him, look, Crito, I'm not going to break out of jail, and I have to find a way to help you come to terms with that. One thing I love about what he ultimately ends up saying about this at the end of the apology is, you know, he sketches one possible scenario, which is quite comic, I think, where, you know, he says, look, one possibility is when we die, it's true, like what they say, and we get to go down to Hades and hang out with everybody. And you know, for Socrates, this is like a vision of really of a kind of heaven where he could resume his philosophical activities. And there's a lot of cool people down there he could test. And I mean, you can imagine like the members of the jury who voted for his guilt sort of being quite horrified by this thought, because they basically think they're getting rid of Socrates. Now, if what's true, you know, if they who believe in the traditional myths, like if it's true, well, guess what? When they die and they pass over to Hades, the first one who's going to be waiting to greet them there is Socrates. And now, like, they can't get rid of him because they're already dead. Like,
yes. So, yeah. You know. Dialogues in limbo. Yeah, there's a funny old, I think it's a 50s comedy skit. It's a shot at McCarthy, but just there's a funny part of it where the Satan comes to heaven from hell, and he's being driven to distraction by all these people who've been wrongly thrown out of heaven and sent to hell. And one of them is Socrates. And the devil says at one point, and that madman Socrates keeps following me around, asking me if I know what virtue is. Me.
Right. No, right. Kierkegaard loves this image. I mean, he says, you can't help but smile in a way, just imagining like the somber shades down in Hades, and there's Socrates in the middle, kind of cross-examining them and asking questions.
Right.
And, you know, obviously from Socrates' point of view, this would be a wonderful thing. And they no longer have the ability to get rid of him in the way that they do at the moment,
right,
which is to put him to death.
Let me ask you one last thing, just to finish up, because it's something that struck me as you were talking about various of the parts of the apology and various features of Socrates' character and occupation. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, Chaerephon asks this question of the oracle, and in effect, the oracle answers no. And then we have Socrates, who's characterized by irony, which itself looks like a kind of no-saying activity. We have Socrates, you know, saying, no, I can't leave jail. We have this demonic voice to him. I mean, it's just striking in a way that all of this, and perhaps it's, you know, best represented in Plato's Socrates, all of this, let's call it non-logical but still negating activity seems to characterize him. It's just fascinating feature of him. The word no, in a certain sense, keeps coming up as often as it seems to come up. And it's hard to resist the thought that it's connected to, of course, his claims of ignorance, since if his divine voice really did what Xenophon thought it would do and supplied him, as it were, with positive answers, then it would have been hard to see how he could have claimed not to know things. Because if nothing else, he'd at least have them on the authority of his demon, of his voice.
Right, that's a nice point. And I don't remember Socrates' ignorance actually playing much, if any, role in the way that Xenophon talks about Socrates. I mean, for him, he is very much a sort of a religious and self-disciplined paradigm, like somebody that right. The way he led his life was admirable in all sorts of respects. And that's where you do sort of get that problem. Like, if he's as great as he's portrayed by Xenophon, you kind of wonder, well, what's the problem? Like, how could we ever get to the point where Socrates was viewed as a kind of deep threat by the state and by maybe certain elites and all these kinds of things? I mean, that's the way in which, it seems like he's in trying to save the reputation of Socrates, he's kind of muddled the problem. Like, I mean, the way that Kierkegaard puts it, finally, like the state has gotten clear about the sense in which Socrates is a real threat, right? I mean, and he's drawing on Hegel. Like, Hegel has the idea that the state is quite justified, he says, in putting Socrates to death, while Socrates was also justified in the kind of criticism that he engaged. And so in both of their cases, yeah, that negating activity you're talking about is critical. I mean, from Hegel's sort of world historical perspective, you have these kind of moments sometimes where, right, we move from one form of consciousness to another. And sometimes yes. You'll have these transitional figures who themselves maybe aren't going to be a part of the new formation of consciousness, but the role they play is kind of helping to reveal the contradictions and the things that make the old way of living and being no longer viable or something like that. So that, like the way that Kierkegaard has this great image, he says, Socrates launched the boat of speculation, but he himself does not get on the boat or something like that. Mm. So there's a way that you can see him as, and this is something, I think there's an image or there's a passage in Plato's Sophist where he talks about one type of sophist who it looks like a little portrait of Socrates, where it's a valuable activity. It kind of, you engage in a kind of cleansing of the soul, a kind of removing of this kind of ignorance. And then once you've done that, now you're ready to learn. Mm-hmm. Now you're ready to learn something substantive. But that's sort of all that Socrates does. That's all, I mean, in a way, all he seems to do is, you know, dismantle, remove, refute. He has maybe even a kind of lust for that. That's what he's good at. That's what comes naturally to him. Presumably that's what he did a lot of the time leading up to Chaerephon asking the question, right? That's what he does right. When he initially tries to grapple with the riddle of what they say. But his ignorance seems to go right along with that, that there is this kind of fundamental way in which and Kierkegaard and other, I mean, I think others as well, but Kierkegaard is really clear that he does not think that Socrates' ignorance is ironic itself at all. It is genuine ignorance.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He thinks of almost more like that Kierkegaard's irony is a response to the condition yes. of ignorance. I mean, you could respond to ignorance in different ways. I mean, he thinks that in a way, like the value that he plays historically is he kind of clears the deck and then the boat of speculation launches. And so one response to this seeing that we're ignorant is, oh, well, we better figure out the answers and let's see if we can come up with better methods. And that's where the history of philosophy goes off. But Socrates is almost kind of like, he just enjoys the dismantling part so much that he kind of thrives on that. He lives on that. He can generate oxygen from that in a way that maybe others can't. Right. And so for him, that's where he just kind of always remains this sort of essentially negating figure.
Great, great. Well, Paul, this has been a terrific conversation. I've really been glad to have a chance to have you on the podcast. And I'm certain that anyone who's been listening will be eager to go back and look at the Apology again after hearing what you've had to say about it. So let me thank you one more time.
Well, I really enjoyed it, and thanks for inviting me.
All right. Well, take care.
You too.
I thank Professor Minch for joining us to talk about Socrates. I want to finish today by reading a passage from The Concept of Irony, Kierkegaard's PhD dissertation. This is from the final chapter of the book entitled The Truth of Irony. When irony has been mastered in this way, when the wild infinity wherein it storms consumingly forth has been restrained, it does not follow that it should then lose its significance or be wholly abandoned. On the contrary, when the individual is correctly oriented, and he is this insofar as irony is mastered, only then does irony acquire its proper significance and true validity. In our day, there is much talk about the significance of doubt for philosophy, but doubt is, for philosophy, what irony is for the personal life. As philosophers claim that no true philosophy is possible without doubt, so by the same token, one may claim that no authentic human life is possible without irony. When irony has first been mastered, it undertakes a movement directly opposed to that wherein it proclaims its life is unmastered. Irony now limits, renders finite, defines, and thereby yields truth, actuality, and content. It chastens and punishes, and thereby imparts stability, character, and consistency. Irony is a disciplinarian, feared only by those who do not know it, but cherished by those who do. He who does not understand irony and has no ear for its whisperings lacks eo ipso what might be called the absolute beginning of the personal life. He lacks what at moments is indispensable for the personal life, lacks the bath of regeneration and rejuvenation, the cleansing baptism of irony that redeems the soul from having its life in finitude, though living boldly and energetically in finitude. He does not know the invigoration and fortification which, should the atmosphere become too oppressive, comes from lifting oneself up and plunging into the ocean of irony, not in order to remain there, of course, but healthily, gladly, lightly, to clad oneself again. That's from near the end of The Truth of Irony, near the end of The Concept of Irony by Kierkegaard. Thank you for tuning in. I hope that everyone is well and safe, doing as well as can be expected in the midst of our current conditions. Wash your hands, read Plato's Apology, and listen for the sound of thinking.